Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so let me tell you a story about something that happened after our last conversation. I have a friend who sets up house shows for music, and he likes singer-songwriters, and there's this interesting website where you can kind of open your house to artists and then ask them to kind of show up at your house and play, and then you promise to sell a certain number of tickets, and it's really a cool thing. And this guy's name is Clem Slade, I think his name is. Clem Snide. And he's kind of a B-level guy. He's not like a top-level guy, but he's a singer-songwriter, real soulful, from the East Coast that my friend had gone to school in the area where he was really popular. And this guy happened to be traveling over here, and so he has a house show with this guy. And he's really, really good artist, but I'm setting up to watch. I'm kind of in the front row of this little house, and my son and I are there waiting for him to get going, and he's kind of warming up, and he's kind of looking at me sideways, you know, and I'm like, oh, this is kind of weird. And then he says, you know, do I know you? And I said, I don't think so. You know? And then he said, you're Dr. Jim. And I said, Dr. Jim, I knew exactly what he was talking about. He had seen me on our conversations, and immediately we were friends, and we were talking about how this guy had seen me on your show. And it was all of a sudden this just conversation with him. I was like his best friend at the show. So it was really cool. And so there's this weird thing going on out there.
That's insane. I mean, yeah. These videos get 1,000, 2,000 views. Yeah. That's not a lot.
Yeah. And so he's driving, what he does is he drives around, he has bigger shows in places like Portland and Seattle and bigger places. And then between those shows, he'll drive around and do these house shows. And it was just a lot of fun.
Wow. Wow. That's that, you know, whenever something like that happens, because again, I mean, really there's 300 plus million people in the United States. I mean, that's a lot of people. And some people look at my, oh, you get lots of people, but yeah, 1,000, 2,000 views, right, that's nothing.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So
anyway, that was fun. That was fun. So
that's crazy.
This thing keeps rolling on, this thing you're
doing. Yeah, it does. It does. You know, and I still sometimes I think, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? This is a little insane, but it's so much fun. Yep. And it's been so meaningful, and it's opened up lots of interesting opportunities and more interesting conversations than I ever could have imagined. So
yep.
I'm not stopping.
Yeah, and you're still holding my interest, you know. You know, Jordan's kind of drifted in the background a little bit because of his troubles. Hope the best for him there. But you still hold my attention, I'll tell you that.
So. Well, I think about that a lot because, you know, okay, so I look at the analytics that come through, and it's like you can see, you know, waves go up and down. And I watch myself watch other YouTubers, and I'll watch this person pretty intensely for a while, and then over here and then over there. I mean, that's sort of how we are. It's kind of the order chaos mapped, unmapped dynamic. So I'm glad I don't do this for a living.
Yeah.
Because well, you really get a sense of how fickle the market or the mob are.
Yep, yep, yep. I could see it just dropping off all of a sudden somebody, and then they've banked a lot on it, and it just turns out not to be the fad of the next phase, and there they go.
Yeah, and I think about that with respect to Jordan. So yeah, he hasn't put out product because he's, you know, obviously got much more important stuff to take care of. But, you know, so Jordan was this, you know, huge thing for a moment, and then the question is, you know, will this last? But then the other question is, will there be another, you know, when he comes back, how will he be? What will he talk about? You know, he certainly struck a nerve. I mean, the man and moment met each other at a time, and really, you know, broke open a lot of other cool stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean, we can only be grateful.
Yep, definitely, definitely. So I kind of got fascinated again by you when you took a turn a few weeks ago with the Group B, Group A
nationalism
thing you did. You're kind of a wanderer, you know.
I am a real wanderer. ADHD.
You went off in two or three different directions between then and now. But that's a thing that's close to my kind of... I don't know, my world because of what I do as a physician, and it kind of made me think I'd be interested in having a conversation with you about that topic. So that's how I got this going.
Well, I think there is something to the fact that both of us work with people.
Yes.
And both of us, well, especially you as a physician, because in so many ways, physicians demystify and disenchant our bodies, which is, you know, you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you these things and it's like, is that true? Is that me? Because the me I experience is this, again, non-decaying autobiography that goes through time, that is the center of my story. That's me. And then there's this body that's aging and losing hair. And, you know, my sister died, so now I have a cardiologist because, you know, my sister and my father both died of heart attacks. So now, you know, I don't have any heart trouble, but I have a cardiologist now.
Exactly, right.
And so bit, I said, go ahead.
Bit disconcerting to live in that world, although I would say, and that's kind of the area that I'm interested in kind of exploring a bit. Because in a way, for me, I live within it so much that I kind of get to a sense, a place where, you know, I don't really have that cognitive dissonance between what I'm doing with the patient as a whole person, the patient has autonomy, the patient is a full-fledged agent, they have... They violate the determinism of the universe on a regular basis. They're part of a story within their family. They're part of a story that is their narrative of their lives. And yet I'm thinking about what's happening to them mechanistically and in fully naturalistic and materialistic terms, which is, of course, exactly what I should be doing. And in a way, when I'm dealing with patients and engaged one-on-one, with the whole activity, there isn't cognitive dissonance, you know, right at that level. And that's, I think, interesting to note. I had a direction I was going to take this, and I can run with that for a minute, and then I'll let you think about it. So I was going to pull out a kind of example that's more ordinary than maybe the heightened intensity of my, you know, kind of work with patients, and illustrate some things and kind of move towards a claim that I'm a card-carrying naturalist and materialist, but then move beyond that. Talk about some way in which I'm more than that, let's say. So I'm playing soccer with my son, and we're kicking the ball back and forth. And, you know, as the ball's going through the air, we take it to be the case that that's happening, you know, in a fully naturalistic and materialistic way. Or let me put that in a little bit of different terms. The ball's going to travel invariantly in a certain way. And I recognize that. I know that to be the case. And I use the word invariant rather than using words like deterministic or bound up in causal relations. Because I want to emphasize the point that we take it to be that without any of that thought. We recognize it as that. And we also see the ball and its environment as, you know, not having agency, or let's use the word inanimate. And so those two words, invariant and inanimate, I want to kind of stand in for the direct experience of these more kind of abstracted things that we take to be the case, or that we maybe question sometimes, like naturalism or the kind of iron box of causal relations or the laws of nature or the materialistic view, which was the second kind of the inert nature of it. So I don't have to evoke anything like, you know, some atomic theory of matter or any, you know, any of that, in order to be recognizing that it is that. And so, and in maybe one more step, it's unexceptionally that. And what I mean by unexceptionally here is that might be illustrated by my reaction to anomalies. So if the ball's going back and forth, you know, and then one time it hits the grass and boom, it goes off into a weird direction. I do not say that something from outside that little field of action came in and broke in and made it do that. I say there must be a reason for that, or I search out the reason for that, and I find that there's a sprinkler head there. It hit the sprinkler head that I didn't see, and that's what is the case. So even in the case of an anomaly, I see my own intuition, my own instinct to say that it's contained within this field of what I've called invariant, inert, and unexceptioned. And again, the reason I say that is that I want to emphasize that we know it that way, or we engage in it that way, before we do some sort of rational reconstruction of that that layers on some other level of thinking about it, some abstract level of thinking about it from some theory of science or some, and that's kind of a starting point. I have other directions to go from that, but that's kind of a starting point. Of course, at the same time, I'm playing soccer with my son, and he is a person, and he's got agency, and he's going to kick the ball where he pleases. And I'm, you know, I regard him as someone I recognize. He recognizes me as a full-fledged person. We have relationships of dependency. We have histories. All those things are there as well. And they're there in a kind of uncomplicated way at that level of engagement. So that's kind of my starting point. I don't know if you want to throw in some comments.
Well, yeah, I think that's really, that's a really lovely illustration. And we can even pursue, let's see, the spirit of geometry into your son, because let's say you kick around the ball quite a bit with him, having done this many times. On one hand, you don't demythologize him as an agent, yet over time you learn his habits and his patterns, and you learn if the ball comes this way, he likes to approach it this way. If there's this move, he likes to make this move. And so you just have this, you know, you just have these probabilities that you seamlessly work in your head. And of course, when he gets to the level of professional ball players, not only, you know, they watch tapes of each other, they study each other, and they learn, let's say basketball, they learn that this guy always likes to, you know, cut to the right and head down the lane. But, and so you learn that and you practice that. But when the guy does it, the defense doesn't even sit. There's not time for the defense to sit and say, okay, he's heading down the lane. They just respond. And so in fact, practice is all about taking all of this rational cognition and somehow embedding it more deeply in these processes that we aren't fully in control of and off there. So this is I love this illustration. So keep going.
Right. So, you know, you could evoke a Wervecki term, participatory knowledge here. I mean, we're fully, or Heideggerian, we're embedded in the world, we're being in the world. And that, in that sense, is not complicated. But, and so I want to say something else, like, you know, this thing we think of as materialism and naturalism, you know, it's not a, you know, the result of, you know, some dyspeptic, you know, dead white men in the 16th century kind of wanting to foist upon us some, you know, kind of annoying theory to ruin our mood today. You know, that something happened in the Enlightenment that shifted something. And I have a kind of idea about what that is. But at some base level, this is a perennial problem, not a new problem. This is obviously going to go. We can say it's a modern dualism mind-body, but we could use the word spirit-flesh, and we're probably saying very much the same thing, and we could look at Genesis 2:7, and the Lord formed man out of dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and we're probably talking about something very similar. And So in a way, there's a dilemma there, and I think there is a modernist dilemma there, which I kind of want to move towards. But this is the baseline circumstance that has probably been, in some sense, at the center of our experience and our attempt to work out our experience, you know, going a long way back.
Well, I think that's right, and I like how you set it up here, because So on one hand, we're observers of this, and we reflect upon this. We don't just observe and participate. We're now doing this in the sense of self-transcendence, where we're reflecting upon it. And then there's also the desire within us. Well, what is that desire? Well, we would like to know this. Well, why would we like to know this? Well, because we have an intuition that knowledge of this affords us power, opportunity, control, security, because we also have a very real appreciation on our cautionary side that, you know, there's a reason we say people don't like surprises. Now, people do and they don't like surprises. They like pleasant surprises. They don't like, you know, and with your illustration, I did, so at the beginning of the Australia conference on Jordan Peterson, the organizers of the conference set up my conversation, just a brief conversation with James Anderson, the former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. And before I went to Australia, someone had clued me in, said, you should watch this video about him. And it was an interview that when he was a boy, he was playing cricket with his father and he hit a ball, and the ball that he hit killed one of his siblings. I mean, just a tragic, tragic accident. Jeez. But here's, you know, on one hand, we have this father and son kicking around a soccer ball on a lovely afternoon in the grass, and it's all good, and we can do self-transcendence and reflect upon all of this stuff. At the same time, we know that even in a father and son, you know, with a bat and a ball hitting it around, bang, tragedy happens, and that tragedy, you know, for better and worse, sets someone's life in a different direction. So it's not just a ball hitting a sprinkler. And deep down, we know this.
Yes.
It's, you know, and we know this with car accidents. We know this. We're just doing something mindless and bang, the world changes in an instant. And it all seems to be, you know, balls in gravity on lawns. So,
right.
So there's real stuff at stake with this for us.
Yes, absolutely. And the notion of my patient as, you know, as organism, my patient as, you know, complex biochemistry and electrophysiology, you know, that is something in a certain sense my patient is bound up in and governs, to use your word. And I'm going to act within that world, you know, assuming all of that in order to hopefully have a sense, you know, as a culture in medicine of understanding what health is and trying to recognize, you know, suffering as a consequence of this, you know, kind of materialistic vision and make decisions, but those decisions and are not only, but at least partly and heavily materialistically based, naturalistically based decisions to try to achieve those goals. And so, yes, I totally agree with that. I had studied a guy from the 16th century who's a kind of underappreciated scientist, William Harvey. And the reason I studied him was that he was the first guy to correctly describe the circulation of the blood.
Huh.
But his interesting place in history is that he was a contemporary of Galileo. And so Galileo was the purveyor of the Copernican revolution. So now we're looking out at the stars and we're seeing how the Aristotelian vision is kind of not going to hold out. And Harvey at the same time was really taking that same vision and turning it to the organism of the body. He was taking this organ, the heart, which of course had carried all this, the kind of Aristotelian meaning in that world to our very cells. You know, I mean, what was the heart back then but the heart of the matter, but the center, in a certain sense, the center of the universe, because the human being was at the center of the universe, right? And this heart was this kind of source of heat and action and animation of our being. And he described it as a pump. He described it as a mechanical object. And and this, you know, this at the time, Descartes actually reflects back on Harvey as a very big influence to him. And I think it's interesting to speculate a little bit as to why we don't put Harvey in the same kind of place that we put Galileo. Because Galileo can be seen heroically, the stars can still have wonder in a certain way, but boy, you get getting a little personal if you're talking about the very organism that we are. And these are things to, I don't know, reflect on and see
I think that's so amazing. And I, you know, so I, you know, as a pastor in a kind of moderate denomination, the Christian Reformed Church, you know, doesn't go off into creation science or any like that, even though there's a lot of people in the Christian Reformed Church that are fairly literalistic in Genesis. And so the CRC is kind of a moderate and all those things. And so I always, I'm just such an annoying person in many ways because I say things I shouldn't say. And I'll ask some people, I'll say, you know, you want someone to have a biblical cosmology. What do you want someone to have? A biblical anatomy? Do you look to a literalism in the Bible to human anatomy? Because the Bible has a variety of side comments about anatomy within it. So do you go to a doctor and you say, I'm looking for a biblical literalist from a doctor, and I want you to treat my Bible as the way the Bible describes the body? And that's just such a deeply disturbing, you know. And so what I find is that a lot of creation scientists and highly literalistic people act as if they're, their doctors, you know, we're not being fully honest with the world. And so I love this. I knew nothing about this man, but I think you're exactly right, because it's far more disturbing for us as little centers of the universe to imagine that the thing that is keeping us alive is a pump.
Right. So that's, you know, that I find that all that fascinating. Let's see where, and I don't know where to go with it. I do think it frames my worldview, and I don't want to say that I, you know, kind of don't still, I'm not still able to, in my own idiosyncratic faith, I think completely, I wouldn't say square, but completely embrace, let's say, our incarnate reality while still maintaining my faith. I do think it makes my faith pretty idiosyncratic, at least the way I see it. I think I don't know how ultimately, and I mean, we could potentially talk about how I square all those circles, but I don't think it's the same as my fellow parishioners. Let's put it that way.
Probably not.
Pastors
are popularizers. And right, so, right. You know, what you tend to try to do is give broad answers that satisfy a majority of your people, at least to the degree that they won't act up or leave the flock or something like this. And so pastors have all of their own conflicting agendas going on with herds and people and institutions and organizations. So I would be, you know, because it's funny, because I play, you know, as a pastor of a congregation with a lot of older people, the way the script goes is that the person comes back from the doctor, and the doctor says, well, you've got these things going on. And then of course the people come to the doctor and say, well, what does that mean? And what they're looking for usually is some kind of time frame and ability frame. And so the doctor and doctors for the most part do their best to say, first of all, I don't know, but they forget the I don't know part. And then
well,
they listen.
I really try not to forget that I don't know part, but
No, the doctors don't forget it. The patients forget.
Oh, right. Oh, I see what you're saying. Right.
Because I see them on the other end of it. I'm not in there with the doctor hearing what the doctor says.
Sure.
I hear what the person reports the doctor have saying. And so then they will give an answer. And I will often say something to the effect of, well, that's true. What I as a pastor will tell you is that your life is in God's hands, and he will decide the day. And then I will leverage my own story. I'll have to say, you know, my father fainted for some strange reason, and then, you know, was under, you know, intensive scrutiny by his general practitioner, his heart doctor. He was on a heart monitor. He did all of that. And then, you know, it was 2 or 3 days after they had taken off the heart monitor, because everything looked fine. Bang. He drops dead of a heart attack in the middle of having coffee with someone in a pastoral conversation across the table. And it's like, well, and then the poor doctor is like, you know, my mother didn't hold any ill will, but the poor doctor's right. like, you know, I,
we did everything, right?
We did everything.
Yeah, yeah.
But there we are.
We don't control the whole show.
We don't control the whole show. And in fact, even with as far as our knowledge progresses, you know, that just tends to open up. You know, I love the way it was Neil deGrasse Tyson made a point. He said, you know, the progression of knowledge actually also magnifies the amount that we don't know, because that's just simply how progression of knowledge works.
I would say there isn't a single day almost when I'm taking care of patients, seeing lots of different patients, where there aren't numerous circumstances in which I don't really get a handle on exactly how things are and how do I explain that. And it's for a variety of different reasons. It's for, you know, it's for limitations of our testing, maybe limitations of our theories, just the circumstance of the patient won't allow certain things for me to do to get to that. You know, there's a lot of different reasons why there might be mystery around what's happening. But it's always ever present that we're not, you know, we're not covering the field. We don't have the landscape completely laid out, often.
And yet not unlike clergy, you work in a highly liturgical setting. I mean, you dress a certain way. You speak a certain way. There are liturgies, you know, I always reflect on this because now I have two doctors, not one.
Yeah.
And my two doctors don't always agree. So my one doctor says, talk to the other doctor about this. And back and forth we go. It's like, and I feel fine, which is right. exactly what my father said the day before he died. So, but we have all of these liturgies and so it isn't even just, you know, it isn't just you and the patient and the chemistry or the science of the patient and their health. It's, you know, completely within an entire world. And so you are always dealing both with the spirit of geometry, where here's all this hard science and here are our metrics and, you know, these are your
numbers. This is what we can do. This is what we can't do. Right.
And it's also the spirit of finesse, where you're looking at, you're trying intuitively to see as much of the picture as you can in this tiny window of their life and wade in on an aspect of their life, which is life and death, pretty important for all of us. And in a way that, you know, it's incredible what we're doing.
Yeah. And we, you know, always try to keep the caring for the person, you know, at the forefront of what you're doing. So the goals and the intentions and the meaning for the patient is always very much in front of what you're trying to do. So the fact that there's this other kind of scientific way of making decisions does not shield that or make right. that any less important. But.
Well, you don't undermine their agency, but at the same time, I would imagine their agency is almost always an enormously complicating and sometimes frustrating fact. I mean, when I listen to my primary care physician, you know, I'd really like you to lose this weight and I'd really like you to eat this way. And, you know, he's got all these, you know, things that he'd like me to do. And I'm not the best patient in the world, but I'm not the worst patient in the world. But then I see it from his point of view and I think, gosh, I don't know if I'd want his job, because working with people, oh, wow.
Well, you do it every day, I'm sure. But it is true, particularly as a cardiologist, I see essentially, probably not exactly, but essentially everybody. I mean, there's pretty much no one who doesn't come my way eventually. And and so you see a very kind of, I think, a very broad cross-section of the population. So you see a lot of different kinds of people with different ideas about what's going on and different ways of handling it emotionally and intellectually. And so you have to be there for all of them and try to be the thing they want you to be. That's kind of a part of it as well. You used to talk about the liturgy or the way I dress or whatever. There's a certain sense of being, you know, being confident for them, being having a assurance for them that helps everything. Anyway, so, go ahead.
Yeah.
So, you know, this split vision kind of idea is kind of the way I was kind of wanting to wander. And to illustrate this, I would bring up a guy named Wilford Sellers. Now, he's a philosopher from the middle of the 20th century. I don't recommend him really as someone to read because he comes from an analytic tradition. But he kind of undermined the whole analytic tradition by not attacking, but undermining the idea that science could be purely based on empiricism. And he did that from within the analytic tradition. So he kind of stopped, in a certain sense, you might think of him as a guy who stopped the analytic dominance of philosophy in the American, you know, academia. And there's a quote that I would read for him that kind of goes parallel with this and maybe evokes in your mind that first couple of sentences of Maps of Meaning with the field of objects versus arena for action. But he wrote a book called The Philosophy and the Scientific Image of Man, and I'm getting this from the Stanford Encyclopedia page. Philosophy and the Scientific Image of Man describes what Sellers sees as the major problem confronting philosophy today. This is the clash, in quotes, between the manifest image of man in the world and the scientific image. These two images are idealizations of distinct conceptual frameworks in terms of which humans conceive of the world and their place in it. Sellers characterizes the manifest image as, quote, the framework in terms of which man came to be aware of himself as man in the world. But it is, more broadly, the framework in terms of which we ordinarily observe and explain our world. The fundamental objects of the manifest image are persons and things, with emphasis on persons, which put normativity and reason at the center stage. According to the manifest image, people think and they do things for reasons. And both of these can occur only within a framework of conceptual thinking in terms of which they can be criticized, supported, refuted, in short, evaluated. So that's the first posture that he takes on the manifest image. But then he makes the following claim, which is kind of where I wanted to go here, as comparing that to the scientific image, which he doesn't describe more, which isn't described explicitly here, but it's what we were just talking about. And so then the quote goes on. Sellers claims that the scientific image presents itself as a rival image. From its point of view, the manifest image on which it rests is an inadequate but pragmatically useful likeness useful likeness of a reality which first finds its adequate in principle likeness in the scientific image. In other words, the scientific image has within it a kind of impulse towards totalization, an impulse towards being all there is, the whole show, if you will. And I think that's in the description that I gave in terms of this unexceptionalness or this lack of exception. And I think that's kind of where I see kind of a problem or the problem arising, which is that we have a temptation to move towards Sam Harris, let's say. We have a temptation to move towards a sense that things in the manifest image are not quite as real as things in the scientific image, or to put that another way, the two images entail a kind of ontology. So if we see the ball behaving the way it is, coming along with that is the ontology that things are material, that things are bound up in this. We see on the other side the persons and their ontology of that world, which is persons and agency and free will and all of that. But there's a kind of intuition that we have, and perhaps an intuition that this might have been inherited through modernism as perhaps different from before, which is that we set up a hierarchy of being. There's a hierarchy of being rather than a kind of easy coincidence of things, as I described in playing soccer with Kevin. There, when we reflect on it, when we step back, what we do is we start to see things like, well, gosh, you know, free will doesn't seem to be consistent with the scientific image. And that means that I have to put the scientific image at some level of more substantial ontology. And now I'm demoting the manifest image and I'm seeing it as somehow less real. And I'm starting to wonder about terms like emergence to explain it. And now, and ultimately I arrive at Sam Harris, where the self is an illusion. And I see that word illusion when he does that. I don't know if you know that spiel that he has, where he says something like, you know, we know the biochemistry of the brain, and we can see on the MRI that this stuff is happening and that stuff is happening, and we can see in the anatomy that that stuff is there, and that means that the self is an illusion. And that's that same move, and illusion in that sentence functions as a deflationary term. It relegates our direct experience of the world to a lesser status in terms of ontology. You cannot have an ontology that excludes things from existence. Non-existence is not a reality, it's just another category of existence. And therefore it's just a way of kind of, with superlatives and with emphasis, describing something as having less claim on reality rather than, I don't know if you followed all that, but.
Oh, absolutely.
I think the modernist turn in a way has this temptation to set that hierarchy that up that way, and we inherit that, and then we struggle with it because of that, rather than being able to embrace the alternative.
Well, that's excellent. That's excellent, and you'll have to send me the link to that quote, because people will very much want to read that, because
let me try to do that while we're talking here.
Okay. Yep. That's tremendously helpful, because the irony, of course, is that, as I think Peterson notes and many others, we act as if the manifest image is the truer image because we can't do anything else. I mean, and so that then sets up this conflict where, and this morning I was watching, so Rationality Rules, I don't know if you've seen, know who he is, he's a guy out there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Rationality Rules, just Google served up, upper left-hand corner, first video in my feed, a Rationality Rules video with this Greta girl from Sweden or Norway, from Scandinavia, and Jordan Peterson. I thought, yeah, I know why Google's doing that. So I'm working on a video about the movie The Joker, which I saw last night, which is a...
I saw as well.
Did you? That movie is a masterpiece. Anyway.
Crazy, yeah.
So Rationality Rules is doing his thing. And of course, Rationality Rules in some ways epitomizes, or at least aspires to epitomize, the scientific image. That's his whole shtick. Mm-hmm. But what's happening now, and that video is about climate change, of which I am not a skeptic, but that video and a number of other videos are demonstrating that climate change is the near perfect challenge to modernity.
Right, I've heard this argument for you.
Because it's a conflict, and with the things that you just put on the table here, because it's near perfect conflict between the manifest image, for which can't see climate, and the scientific image. So you have all the scientists saying, this is going to kill us. The manifest image shows no danger. And so, you know, all the rationalist people are saying, well, we should rationally address it this way. Oh, but to do that will quite likely first of all, we probably can't do it because most of the carbon emissions are actually going to come from China, India, Africa, and the developing world. And so your real question is, well, just how much violence are you willing to threaten them with in order to put them under a neo-colonial totalitarian regime that has everything to do with carbon, when almost no one in that world is thinking in the scientific image that even hardly anyone in the first world, which is the most educated, the most, you know, colonized, thinks in. And so you can't win this political battle in the developed world. You know, it's basically, we're looking at this thing saying, hey, you know what? We're screwed. We have.
And not to mention the fact that you don't know what to do.
That's right. That's right.
even within the scientific image.
That's right. And so, you know, when I was looking at that, I'm thinking, well, yeah, well, this is the end of rationalism in many ways, because either way this thing goes, rationalism loses. But there we are. And I really love what you just read now, because I think that very, very clearly lines up the relationships and shows the kinds of conflicts that are just playing out again and again beneath all the turbulence that we're seeing.
Yeah, and I think it's one place where I can kind of feel like we have kind of a reserve of agency is this sense of setting up our ontological hierarchy, because we don't have to think of ourselves as, you know, insubstantial. We do in fact think of persons as wholes, even if parts of them no longer partake. You know, someone breaks their leg, or God forbid, has a stroke, and I hope we're all thinking that that person is still the same person and is deserving of all of the compassion and or rights and or all the things that we attribute to them as full persons, including our love for them and our belief in them as you know, as fully substantial in just the same way before they lost one of their parts. So, you know, that's a normative demand that plays only in that arena of our ontologic choices, or our choices about what we take to be existent and important. And so that's where the manifest image is. You know, we gotta not get tempted, and I use the word tempted on purpose, not get tempted to dismiss that. So,
how do we manage both image? Because obviously at this point, we're not giving up the scientific image.
No,
I mean, because our lives depend on it in right. many, many aspects. here in Northern California now, last year we had the Paradise Fire, which was likely caused by sparking power lines in the north winds that we get every year. And so, big electric, not a lot of people have a lot of love for PG&E for a whole host of reasons. And so the state of California was going to hold PG&E accountable for all the loss in those fires. And they weren't going to let PG&E slip out of it if they went bankrupt. And so this year, PG is just turning off power in many areas of Northern California when the winds are high. And, well, this is a very astute scientific move to make. But now, in terms of the manifest image, people get up in the morning and the power is out, and they worry about their milk in the fridge, and people have medical equipment in their homes, and people have to go to work, and they discover that the gas station is closed because the gas pumps don't work without power, and so... No, this is a wonderful way of setting up the dilemmas that we face, because we're not about to discard the scientific image. No. We can't, but we neither can
partly
we
because
the
it's image. Right, exactly. And the question is how do we, you know, I don't know that there's any answer to these things, of course, but it does seem like we've moved to a place where the these priorities have been inherited by people, and it foists a burden on a lot of people that I think let's go back to John Vervaeke, the psychotechnologies that we have available are not quite up to, you know, navigating. And we don't, and maybe they never were, you know, that's part of the deal. Maybe we don't, you know, maybe we struggle to be communities that can make decisions as communities with the kind of priorities that, I hate to use the word should, that we should. Maybe we never were able to do that, but it certainly seems like we should, you know.
Well, we should, and you know, your image too, as a pastor, one of the increasingly common and yet trying dynamics that you see in families is our memory issues and memory loss of parents and loved ones. And you know, it's when it comes to, you know, as we're seeing now in the golden age of brain science, these issues when it comes to the brain, they get accentuated, because in many ways I can, you know, it's a little bit easier for me to differentiate myself from, let's say, my ticker, my little pump in here, because maybe put another pump in if all it has to do is pump the blood. But when it comes to this thing that's generating the autobiography, and now suddenly I can't remember, or there's a stroke, and I see this fairly often, then there's a change in personality after the stroke, along with a change in capability. Then people are looking at, you know, well, I've lost my husband. And my husband is still there, but I've lost my husband. And I mean,
yeah,
these are huge issues.
Yeah, I think this kind of dovetails into another direction I had thought of going into, which was to critique Jordan Peterson's half of the, you know, field of objects versus arena for action. And I think arena for action is probably wrong. And the reason that arena for action is wrong is that it's no really, in a certain sense, it's no different than a field of objects. That is to say, actions aren't in themselves, they don't have any value. So, you know, you can take the field of objects and you can say, you know, I can stack up a bunch of objects in a lot of complicated different ways, but it just turns out to be a stack of objects. And the same is true with actions. You can put a sequence of actions, all sorts of complicated sequence of actions together, but it's only a sequence of value neutral actions until you do something else. And so I think you get to Nietzsche with that formula. Now, I don't think Jordan Peterson is doing this, because he obviously moves quickly to meaning and goes into other directions. So I'm not wanting to lay this on Jordan Peterson. But simply saying, as a starting point, that the fundamental essence is action, I think leads to a power kind of dynamic. And I think we move to something else. I toyed with the term care, which is a Heideggerian idea that it's a field that we care about. Things are things that we care about, and then we act based on our care. But I even go to another level that I think your comment raises, and that is that our essence really in our manifest images is dependence. We either have people who are depending on us, or we are dependent on others. We are dependent in our very nature from our origin to our final act. And that's the dynamic we're in, even with the neutral, or however you want to describe the universe or the absolute, we are dependent in our kind of central essence. And recognizing that, I don't know, may make a bit more sense out of the manifest image. I don't know.
I think it's really good. You know, it's, you know, so Vervaeke goes with his relevance realization as kind of a, I think it's a more, I think it's a more developed, it's a more developed alternative to action because it's fuller, especially when he puts the two words together, because that second word has a double aspect to it. It's both mental and it's physical. And because realize has that double dynamic in English and in some other languages as well. But you're right that a, you know, a sequence of actions is, can be just as valueless, which isn't as a sequence of, as a pile of objects, and which is what the, you know, one of Jordan Peterson's favorite illustrations of the Nazi prison guard having, you know, prisoners haul sacks of sawdust back and forth across the factory floor. Yeah. I mean, that's the image of it, that the point of the story is a valueless exercise in order to reinforce valueless, but there is in fact care behind that. And then the question is, well, what is that? We're back into meaning, we're back into value and the quest for these things and attempting to square. I mean, in some ways we're back to Hume's is and ought, that we're working on the intersection of these. And again, it's all of these, it's all of these things that we bump up against: mind, matter, is, ought. And these things tend to line up fairly well, heaven and earth in some ways.
I think that's right.
And so we're working through those things. No, that's really, really helpful.
Yeah. And it worries me that power also, or let's say action, can seem to have a quality of that we would honor in the form of competence. So competence might be thought of as hey, that's a way that this I can be more comfortable with or something. But I don't really think so, because being competent, we're not always competent. Sometimes we're not competent, and sometimes we're weak, and sometimes we're ultimately relegated to being passive and being dependent on others. And so we can't, plenty of us are not competent. And we have to see ourselves in that relationship with each other. And we can't just, we can't just judge people simply based on competence. You know,
nested within it a telos, a goal, an end.
Right.
I mean, it's always competence towards something.
Yeah.
And again, it's the telos and outcomes that, especially in the secular frame, we are so bad at, because secularity, by setting itself up, you know, wants to push those things away, which leaves Jordan Peterson with a sort of internal compass of meaning. But I really like your point on dependence, which of course is deeply biblical in that what is man? Well, man is like the flower of the field that flourishes, is full of glory for a moment, but then its place remembers him no more. I mean, and you look at the artistry of, you know, of course, this is something that I, as a pastor, I read this a lot with older people. And so as I'm trying to facilitate their negotiation with their often impending death, you know, this is, so we go back, because on one hand, we want to leverage the promises of the Bible for meaning and purpose and never endingness that is the promise of the religion. But at the same time, there's a realization of the religion that this thing that you have feared and you rightly have kept pushing away, that's this thing is an inevitability that you will not win, no matter what action, no matter how many objects you line up.
That's right. And this goes to a kind of an image of the cross that I think might be somewhere in the Girard, Rene Girard thing. But you know, one of the ways I frame the crucifixion is a kind of declaration. Well, let's say we're in a field of action, and we're Peter in the garden, and the the soldier comes up he sees, this is it. This is the beginning. We're going. This is the fight we've been preparing for. And he pulls out his sword and he says, let's go. And Gerard's, I don't know if you got to that point in the Gerard comments, but Gerard frames this exactly right, because what would happen at that moment, if that were the case, if Jesus had taken up the sword with Peter, what would have happened? Well, it would have been a complete mess, obviously, and it would have undone the whole thing. And Jesus, of course, knows this. And he goes through the passion and he is crucified as a kind of declaration of something like, death cannot be seen as failure. It cannot be seen, if you're gonna put competence, let's go back to that. If you're gonna put competence at the top, you're not gonna be able to be competent enough to have that not happen. And so the cross is a declaration, an affirmative declaration that death is not failure. Because if death is failure, then that's the end. That's, if narrative defines what, you know, what we take as meaningful, and death is failure, then that's going to be all of our stories. And so I think it's a symbolic, but, you know, let's say real for Christians, it's a real declaration that says that we could be in our incarnate life without that being the defining narrative. And I'll let you run.
That's wonderful. That'll preach. I'm robbing that thing. I'm robbing that thing hard. I think that's terrific. And I think that's right. Because, and that's, again, I think part of why the climate controversy is the perfect storm for rationality, because the value implicit in the value implicit in the humanist rationalist project is, in fact, that we can employ science, and of course anything that we employ is by definition not at the top of the hierarchy, because it is serving that which is employing it. We can employ science in order to beat death. And this is why I love C.S. Lewis's Life in an Atomic Age, because, you know, in the late 40s, everybody's freaking out because now the Soviets have the bomb too. And everyone's falling all over themselves. And C.S. Lewis said, well, what kind of world did you think you were living in? Which is exactly the right question, that you had imagined both that, you know, maybe death isn't inevitable, or at least we can have death on our terms, but death is a failure and something which should be avoided. And Lewis comes and, of course, as a Christian, says, well, number one, no, you're not getting out of, none of us are getting out of this alive. That's right. And we all know that. But we have concocted an enormous culture around, you know, Beckett's term, the denial of death. A book that Peterson thinks is a wonderful book, but deeply flawed. The denial of death, and so then we can continue to live in this life over here where we push it off and push it off, and then when it happens, well, then we'll either kick over to religion and say they're in a better place. Or we take that. I find very few atheists, shooting their mouth off at gravesides personally, to say, well, yeah, they're nothing now.
Right. Well, that was a waste.
That doesn't sell at the funeral. Jim, that was really, I could not have said it any better myself. And that's just simply fantastic. And I love, you know, how you set up this scene in the garden too, because, you know, if you take the image of Jesus that we see in the Gospels of someone stilling a storm with a word and someone raising the dead with a word, well, you want to talk about power, you know, is it easier to make a storm? So one of the members of my congregation is involved in cloud seeding and some of those kind of things. Is it easier to make a storm, or at least to enhance a storm, or to still a storm? Is it easier to raise the dead or to cause death? Well, we've been causing death, you know.
Seems like the obvious answer to that one is
apparent. And so then, you know, the assumption in, as Girard would say, the kingdom of Satan would be that Jesus would use his power to cause the death of his enemies. And he completely inverts that, and he refuses to use his power. In fact, he uses minor power to, you know, he calls his disciples off, he heals the servant's ear, he goes willingly to the cross, and you know, all of the scenes in the Gospels, all of his trial scenes, make it abundantly obvious that, and he didn't even need a lawyer to avoid the cross. Right. And Pilate's practically pleading with him, give me any excuse. I would love to stick it to these guys who are bringing it. I would love that. And my wife is, you know, talking in my ear, don't hurt this man. Give me any excuse at all not to crucify you. And Jesus just simply will not play his game at any level. And that's where, in a weird way, you know, Jesus and the Joker, you know, I won't give too many spoilers, but there's a scene in that movie which is right out of classical Christian imagery. And Jesus, in a sense, like the Joker, simply defies every narrative that all the competing elements are bringing to him. And so they have no choice but to kill him. That's all you can do with such a person.
Yeah.
And so then he's the victim. And he's God. And that's why, that's how Rene's Girard's stuff is so powerful.
Yeah, I'm really going to follow you along as you dive into that, because I really find him to be fascinating for sure.
Yeah. It'll bring some good stuff.
Let me give a quick plug here. My son, I told you before, my son is in a band, and there's one of his songs that I put in that email. It's called Black Magic. The band is called The Slow, and they're on Spotify. And I'm, you know, it's just a little local band, so it's not like this is going to go anywhere. But I really think that song just kind of goes along with what my son's a really, he's a creative, smart, you know, he's a very passionate kind of guy when he writes poetry, and his poetry is in that song. So I just, Black Friday is the name of the song. That's in that email there.
Okay. I will put the link in the notes.
Here's the album right here. It's got an album.
And we'll give him a little bit of, well, who knows, you know, if that artist, you know, heard of us, who knows where this reaches.
Exactly. I was thinking, oh, you know, who knows what'll happen.
So it's like, Dad, could you talk to Paul Vanderclay again and get my album up on his channel?
He would not say that. He could be embarrassed by this. It's all right. That's all right. That's okay.
Well, Jim, this is wonderful as always, and thanks for listening, and thanks for...
Oh, and another plug for Mary, I just to say it out loud, Mary, I really, you know, Mary Cohen is her name? Yeah.
I really
like her stuff, so everybody should listen to her. She's a smart lady, kind of crazy how I can't, here's my prejudice. I wouldn't have thought that someone coming from where she comes from, I would have been prejudiced against that person.
Yeah. Yeah,
and she is very impressive in that, and that just opens my eyes to a lot of things. And then she's reading Ratzinger, which is definitely worthy. So I just throw that plug out as well.
Yeah, Mary, I, you know, and in fact, I'm
need a few more female voices out there. You know.
Yeah. Well, and Karen too. Karen Wong, the stuff that she's doing, I'll often watch her stuff, and I'll, you know, she'll just really spark ideas and. Yep. The conversations that are going on the Randos channel it's just been wonderful. And there's more good stuff out there than I have time to listen to, which is regrettable, but that's, as a Christian, I console myself, because when we've been there 10,000 years bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise. And part of how we sing that praise is we have conversations and we listen, and so
come together.
That's right. So thank you, Jim. This has been terrific.
Thanks again.
And I'll post this probably sometime next week. It'll get out there.
Perfect. Thanks again, Paul.
All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.